righty. And we'll hear first from Mr. Caruso.
May it please the court, Michael Caruso, Assistant Federal Defender, on behalf of Mr. Carter, and also to dispel the notion that Mr. Adler is the only lawyer at the Federal Defender's Office. But like the previous case, Mr. Carter's case also involves the lack of adversarial testing. Before trial, the district court judge asked the prosecutor if the minor witness who was identified in counts 3 and 4 would be a witness in the trial. The prosecutor said no, but offered no explanation as to why the minor witness would not be appearing. Certainly, the prosecutor never made a proffer that they had made a good faith attempt to secure the minor's appearance at trial. Nevertheless, at trial, they did introduce the minor's statement made to the police after she was detained during a sting operation that exculpated herself and accused Mr. Carter of sex trafficking. By doing so, the government evaded the basic purpose of the Sixth Amendment's right to confrontation, that witnesses against a person come into court, swear an oath, and are subject to cross-examination. We think, based on the facts of this case, that the district court judge violated Mr. Carter's right to confrontation. The minor witnesses who went by the name of Amber, statements to the police in the hotel room after the sting operation were clearly testimonial. An objective witness would reasonably understand that those statements would be available for a later prosecution, and indeed they were. We also say that this was not a so-called emergency exception to the confrontation clause. The Supreme Court has made clear that the existence of an emergency, which we say did not happen here, but even if an emergency occurred, is not dispositive to the issue. Finally, because the government in closing argument referred to Amber's statement as part of the gold standard of evidence that they had presented to the jury, we don't think that the government can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless. So we think Mr. Carter's conviction should be reversed based on that violation of his right to confrontation clause. In the alternative, we don't think the statement should have come in under the federal rules of evidence. The judge found that this out-of-court statement came in or was admissible under Federal Rule of Evidence 8032, the excited utterance.
How is it not an excited utterance? You have a minor who is a sex trafficking victim in a hotel room waiting for the man who has paid for her services to walk in, and instead the police walk in, and the police have described the situation as she was having an emotional meltdown.
Well, to back up, Judge, so there are three requirements for the excited utterance, as you know: a startling event, the person being under the sway of excitement, and the statement relating to the startling event. The cases that we've cited in our briefing really go to show that, one, this is not the type of startling event that triggers admissibility under Rule 803.2. Because Amber was 17 years old. She had been doing sex work, unfortunately, prior to coming to Miami. She had been arrested and convicted before. And like the court said in Sewell, the case we cited in our briefing, when someone is knowingly committing a crime, the fact that they are arrested cannot really be considered a startling event, in that it's reasonably to be expected when you're committing a crime that you may be arrested. So we think under the Sewell case, which we principally rely on, it was not a startling event.
And I know in your briefing you've referred to her as an experienced sex worker, but why should we not take her as she is, which is a minor who is a victim of sex trafficking, and especially as we evaluate the excited utterance?
Right. I think you can definitely take into consideration her age, but I think that is just only one factor. Again, based on the Sewell case, the fact that she's been arrested while she's knowingly committing a crime and had previous interaction with the criminal legal system, I think is another factor. And the part of the reason we didn't have any adversarial testing in this case, right? We weren't able to cross-examine Amber. And the issue is that the police officer who testified about her statement, yes, said she was having an emotional reaction, but also said she was having a temper tantrum, which again seems to me different than being under the sway of excitement. She was angry and frustrated that she had been arrested, and we think that that takes that out of the excited utterance exception. But even if it came in properly as an excited utterance, we still believe that the admission of this evidence violated Mr. Carter's right to confrontation.
Can I skip ahead for just a moment?
Absolutely.
Why wouldn't it have been harmless? I mean, the statements that she made were that she was being, that, you know, she was being coerced to be there, basically. But that wasn't really an element of the charged counts, was it?
So yes and no. Mr. Carter was not charged by trafficking her by force, but the elements of both accounts where Amber was the identified victim, counts 3 and 4, required the government to prove that Mr. Carter intended she engage in prostitution.
But isn't there like ample evidence of that in the record? I mean, the record does seem to be overwhelming with respect to the evidence of that.
So I don't think so, Your Honor. You know, one, and again, the government referred to this evidence as the gold standard, so they obviously thought that this was important or critical evidence to their case, this statement. But also, the adult victim who testified didn't really say anything about Amber. I think the only direct testimony that she gave was that Amber and Mr. Carter had a friendly relationship. And if you also look at the text messages that were introduced between Mr. Carter and Amber, there is sort of no evidence that he was sort of intending her to engage in prostitution in Miami at that hotel. So we don't think there was overwhelming evidence with regard to Amber for either count 3 and 4. You know, especially for the transportation count, there's no evidence in the record as to why Amber came from Georgia to Miami with Mr. Carter.
I mean, isn't there evidence that that there was an ad of the two of them that that there were statements about there was nothing going on in Atlanta, so we're going down to Miami for the Super Bowl because we can get business there. I mean,
well, the evidence regarding that is not clear, Your Honor. For example, as we point out in our briefing, the trial prosecutor never asked the adult witness whether they were coming to Miami to do commercial sex work. The evidence that came out in the case was that they were coming to Miami so the adult could get a job at a local strip club and dance. And in fact, the evidence supports through text messages that Mr. Carter was communicating with a contact he had in Miami about getting the adult a job at the strip club. So there was absolutely—
That's true, but then there are also, aren't there also, or wasn't there other evidence about how he would teach people how to get business in the VIP rooms at the dancing places, I guess?
So there was evidence from the government's expert and through the adult, but we're talking about Amber here.
But he's trying to get her a job at one of these places.
The adult, not Amber.
Okay.
But Amber's underage. I would assume that probably, because she's under 18, prevents her from getting a job at a strip club. But she's coming to, he was getting commercial sex jobs for the minor, when they were in Atlanta. They said, nothing's going on in Atlanta. He brings the adult victim and the minor victim down to Florida with the Super Bowl, gets the adult victim a job at a strip club where sex work can be found, and there was evidence in the record that he would send them both on jobs, right?
So let me try to unpack that, Judge Brandt. One, you know, the fact that she was 17, like, I don't have a record citation for this, but I think over 90% of high school seniors in the United States have IDs saying that they're over 18. So I think the fact that she was 17 would not have been an obstacle for her to get that job. We also
you're saying she might have had a fake ID, but there's no evidence in the record.
Right.
So if there's no evidence in the record, we have a minor who's 17 who would not be able to work in a strip club.
That's right. But this is the government's burden to prove harmlessness. The other is there is no evidence that Mr. Carter was working with Amber to get her commercial sex work in Georgia. The evidence in the record was that he did do that with the adult witness, but there is no evidence, one, because Amber didn't testify and wasn't asked these questions, and the adult who did testify really never testified about the relationship she had with Mr. Carter, except to say that they had a friendly relationship. So I think, sort of based on the record, we disagree that the evidence was overwhelming, with at least with regard to Amber and counts 3 and 4, and I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Didn't AV also testify that the adult victim, testify that Carter told the women to sleep on the drive because when we got there, we were going to work?
Yes, and that's unclear whether that was referring to commercial sex work or working in the strip club. Again, the trial prosecutor never asked the adult witness what she understood that statement to mean. And again, the adult witness was abundantly clear that she wanted to go to Miami to work at a strip club. I'm over my time, but we also have serious issues regarding the constructive amendment of the indictment for counts 2 and 4.
I thought you were going to answer you were answering the question. I don't mean to suggest otherwise, but let me just ask you one other thing related to that, because I want to make sure that I've given you the opportunity to address some of the other issues, which I think seem like they're kind of overwhelming evidence. There was also evidence that both the adult victim and Amber together went on the $1,200 sex date within the first day that they arrived in Miami. And the adult victim testified that Mr. Carter had facilitated the date by posting the online ad. I mean, and the ad, of course, featured both of them, and it described the minor victim as a one-in-a-million experience. And the adult victim gave Carter the money right after this joint date. So why isn't that enough to show that he knew what was going on and was there facilitating her prostitution?
So again, if I could separate out counts 3 and 4, with regard to the transportation, you know, as we argued in our brief, the intent to engage in commercial sex work or prostitution has to be intended prior to the transportation over state lines. So we think events that occurred in Miami after there was an attempt to get work at a strip club don't really come into play with regard to that, and certainly the government can't rely on that to overcome their burden. And again, with regard to count 3, you know, the issue is that the jury heard through Detective Villa that Amber said she was forced to do this without any adversarial testing, without any cross-examination, when there was absolutely no evidence in the record that Mr. Carter was forcing Amber to do anything. Again, the adult witness said that they had a friendly relationship and had nothing to do with force. So we think that the importance, the impact that statement, that Mr. Carter didn't have an opportunity to test through cross-examination, you know, renders his conviction sort of unfair because of a violation of the Confrontation Clause.
All right, thanks for taking the time to explain your view on that to me. I appreciate it. And we'll hear next from Mr. Romano. And Mr. Romano, I took Mr. Caruso over, so we're gonna give you 3 extra minutes. Don't think of it as a challenge. You don't have to use all your time if you don't want to, but if you want to, it's there.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, John Alex Romano. On behalf of the United States, I'd like to begin by addressing the Confrontation Clause challenge to the admission of the minor victim's out-of-court statements. There was no confrontation violation because the statements were not testimonial. They were not made for the primary purpose of producing an out-of-court substitute for trial testimony. They arose in the context of the police's response to an ongoing emergency involving human trafficking.
But let me ask you, I mean, the content of those statements, it seems like the content of those statements, how does that relate to what was happening there? Why isn't that, you know, her attempts to give an exculpatory?
I think that the content of the statements actually work in favor of viewing this as an ongoing emergency situation, at least within the first 30 seconds when these statements are made. And that's the time frame that we're talking about. And the court can verify the testimony on the 30 seconds at pages, I think, 108 to 109 of docket entry 181. But, you know, the lead up to this police encounter is that law enforcement is conducting an operation to identify potential victims of human trafficking. And as Your Honors noted, Detective Villa was responding to an ad in Mega Personals showing 2 females. One was young, and it had indicia of sort of red flags of human trafficking going on. And then, again, this is just in the lead up to the encounter, but Detective Villa, after arranging the date, receives a call from the minor victim that she's on her way to the hotel, and in the background, he hears a male voice giving an instruction to the minor victim. Okay, that is reason to believe that could be the victim's pimp. And when she arrives in the hotel room, before the law enforcement comes in, Detective Villa testified that she appears nervous, unsure of herself. She appears young, like a deer in the headlights. All of these are, you know, again, potential indications of human trafficking. And then when law enforcement comes in, within the first 30 seconds, the minor victim breaks down. She loses control of her emotions. Yes, Detective Villa said she's throwing a temper tantrum, but she's bawling. The clear, you know, indication is that she's lost control of her emotions. And she says, "I don't even want to be here. I was forced to come." She's effectively saying, "I'm a victim here." And then, according to Detective Villa's testimony, the officers try to calm her down, sort of say who they are. They're there for her welfare, her safety. And then it's at that point she makes the additional statement about offering to view her phone. So I think the spontaneity of her statements, the immediacy with which they happen, the fact that she's saying, "I'm here against my will," all point to this being.
But another fair interpretation would be she's worried about getting arrested, and so she's trying to give an explanation about why she shouldn't be.
That would be one factor that the court could consider. And of course, the Supreme Court says you have to look at this objectively from all sides, right? The perspective of the law enforcement, of the declarant, of all the circumstances. But I would offer that the fact that this occurs, that the first statement is spontaneous, and the second statement about offering to see the phone is really on the heels of that, as law enforcement is trying to reassure her, that I think that counts more significantly in the analysis than an interpretation that would suggest at this point that she is, and again, going back to the definition of what a testimonial statement is, that she's trying to provide an out-of-court substitute for testimony that's going to be used down the line in trial. And I think if the court looks at, like...
I mean, but if you look at it that way, right, you know, she's giving herself, she can, if she has to go to trial for some reason on this, she gets arrested, she has to go to trial on it, she can say, "I told them as soon as I was arrested, I didn't want to be there and I was being forced."
Understandably, Your Honor, but I think the fact that this occurs, it's a spontaneous statement. The district court made that finding. It's supported by the evidence, and
you can make spontaneous statements that are false exculpatories too. I mean,
and I think considering the fact that this is a minor a victim of human trafficking, there was testimony at trial that human trafficking victims are sort of often have a profound fear of law enforcement because they're taught that law enforcement is enemy number one. So I think that would need to be taken into account too, as just another circumstance. I'm not suggesting that, you know, this situation always remains an emergency. At a certain point, an emergency situation can morph into a backward-looking investigation, but you don't have that here in the first 30 seconds. It's a fluid situation. Law enforcement is coming in. They're trying to establish control of the situation and reassure the victim. And I think we also have to bear in mind, just one last point on the emergency exception or the ongoing emergency doctrine, that at that point when the minor victim makes the statements, officers still don't know where the pimp is. Again, they have reason to believe that she has a pimp, but she says she's there against her will. They heard, Detective Veer heard a male voice in the background when minor victim calls that she's on her way. The pimp could have been in the lobby. He could have been waiting outside in the car. And Detective Veer knew that, you know, he'd only negotiated a one-hour date. So certainly, you know, at least within the hour, very strong likelihood that the person who was trafficking the minor victim would come back looking for her. And all that is just to say that in these first 30 seconds, the first minute of this encounter, the government submits that there's a good case for treating this as an ongoing emergency. And there are parallels to the Graham case that we've cited in our brief, where the Seventh Circuit held that a declarant statement identifying a pimp at a motel and saying, telling officers who arrive on the scene that he's up there with the prostitute and he, the pimp, used to traffic me. The Seventh Circuit held that those statements were not testimonial because they rose in the context of the police response to an ongoing emergency. I think you have a similar situation here. I would offer that the circumstances are even stronger for treating this as an emergency situation than in Graham, because in Graham, the declarant was actually handcuffed when she makes the statements. And there, you can see in the Graham decision that the declarant was actually a co-defendant. She was a co-conspirator who, although having been trafficked earlier, went on to help the defendant in his prostitution business.
All right, now let's just assume for the purposes of this question, we haven't discussed this, we haven't made any decisions, but let's just assume for the purposes of this question that we think that there was a violation, or that this is, or that this is inadmissible. Why is this then harmless error, given that the prosecutor at the time described this as the gold standard?
Yes, Your Honor. We do think it is harmless, even under the constitutional standard, harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would just like to place in context the prosecutor's comments, and they occurred during rebuttal, and then I'll turn to the overwhelming strength of the evidence here. But the prosecutor's comments, referring to the gold star evidence, I think it was, occurred during rebuttal. They recur in response to the prosecutor sort of responding to an attack made by the defense's closing on the credibility of the adult victim. And before the prosecutor even refers to the gold star evidence, the prosecutor makes the point that, you know, she defends the credibility of the adult victim and tells the jury, if you believe the testimony of the adult victim, that's all you need here to convict. Oh, but you don't even need to consider this other gold star evidence. And the gold star evidence reference wasn't only to the statements of the minor victim. Also referring to the statements, it was referring to all the evidence that law enforcement collected. So the contents of the abandoned Toyota Corolla, you know, after the police try to apprehend Mr. Carter, he drives off from the Lowe's Hotel and then abandons the black Toyota Corolla. There are a lot of incriminating evidence that's found in that car, including his Georgia identification, his fingerprints, the contents of the cell phones, which were obtained pursuant to search warrants. So that was the reference to gold star evidence. It wasn't just to these particular statements made by the minor victim. And again, it came during rebuttal, all sort of proceeding from a defense of the adult victim's credibility. And then turning to the other points on harmlessness, one, Judge Rosenbaum, as I think you noted to my friend, the statements were collateral to the charges involving the minor victim. Neither sex trafficking of a minor under Section 1591A nor transportation of a minor under Section 2423A requires showing that the minor was there against her will. They do not require a showing of force, fraud, or coercion. And then you look at what the evidence showed that was relevant to the offense elements on those counts. It showed that it was Carter was the one who was trafficking the minor victim, and it showed that his intent all along was to come to Miami for prostitution purposes. Now, as to the identification piece, adult victim testified that, you know, when she returns from that second sex date in Miami on the second day they're there, then, you know, that Carter then took minor victim to her own sex date at the Lowe's Hotel. You also have an in-court identification by Detective Corvo, who attempted to apprehend Mr. Carter at the Lowe's Hotel when he returns to pick up the minor victim. You have the fingerprints in the abandoned vehicle. And then as to the evidence of what Mr. Carter's intent was for this Miami trip, we submit that it is overwhelming that he intended to prostitute both victims in Miami. And we can start by backing up first and considering all the evidence on Instagram, right? Mr. Carter posted on Instagram about being a pimp. He bragged about it. He referred to his victims in denigrating terms on Instagram. He tried to lure victims.
In terms of the count that involved this specific minor, under Judge Rosenbaum's question that she presented to you, if we find that these statements are inadmissible, there are no other statements from this minor victim against Mr. Carter. Is that correct?
That is correct. She did not testify, but simply because she doesn't automatically lead to a confrontation clause violation because they were not testimonial. But Your Honor is correct. Those are the out-of-court statements. But there is other evidence about Mr. Carter's relationship and what he was doing to the minor victim. I disagree with my opponent's characterization that this was, according to the adult victim, they just had a friendly relationship. There was a lot more. The adult victim testified, for example, that in Atlanta, before they take the Miami trip, the adult victim went and stayed with the minor victim in a motel room, and the minor victim would be having sex in the hotel room, but the adult victim was told to stay there in the bathroom to make sure that nothing happened to the minor victim. Right, so there's evidence that Mr. Carter is prostituting the minor victim in Atlanta. Again, they leave Atlanta, according to the adult victim's testimony, because sex work is slow in Atlanta. And Mr. Carter tells them, you better rest during the trip because you're going to get to work once we're there. Sure enough, the first day, both go on a joint sex date with a John, a date that Mr. Carter has arranged for them by posting the Mega Personals ad for $1,200. The testimony is clear that both victims have sex during this date. Adult victim testifies that minor victim had sex with the John first, but then complained that she was hurting, that the John was rough. And so then the adult victim has sex with the John. So there's evidence that on the very first day that they arrive in Miami, Mr. Carter is prostituting them. And as this court, I think, said in the Nicholson decision, some of the most probative evidence of intent to travel, what the purpose of a trip is what goes on during the trip. And you have commercial sex date the first day. The next day, the adult victim goes on a second date with the same John. And then the second day, you know, when she returns, the minor victim is being taken by Mr. Carter to the Lowe's Hotel. And responding to this point about, well, adult victim testified, or that the evidence showed that Mr. Carter wanted to get the adult victim a job at the strip club, that evidence actually hurts Mr. Carter's claim here, because the evidence showed that working at a strip club was a way to generate commercial sex dates, right? The adult victim testified that when she returns to Atlanta, she's still working under the thumb of Mr. Carter. She works at a strip club, a club called Follies, and there she procures 20 to 30 sex dates by virtue of working there. Separately, Mr. Carter messages on Instagram when he's trying to lure a victim into his prostitution ring. He has a message that says, making a play in a club is called BIP. I'm gonna teach you everything. That's pages 178 to 79 of docket entry 183. The same contact in South Florida who Carter is asking about getting adult victim a job at a strip club, he also messages her asking her if she has any Johns because his girl, you know, the adult victim, does that work. And of course, you have the fact that Carter prohibited the minor victim from working at a strip club. So this, really the only evidence, the only purpose that Carter was taking the minor victim down to Miami was for to prostitute her. And certainly in light of all the evidence in the case, we think it shows beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Carter's main purpose, dominant purpose even, was to also prostitute the adult victim in Miami. So for all of those reasons, to return to your question, Judge Rosenbaum, we do think that there is a strong case to make that this was harmless error, and I think that could be one path the court decides that it's unnecessary to resolve the Sixth Amendment challenge and the rule-based challenge to the admission of the minor victim's out-of-court statements. We think harmless error would be a fairly easy path in which to decide this case.
Can you discuss the rule-based challenge that we kind of skipped over that, and I'm curious about your view.
Sure. We do think that the Rule 8032, the excited utterance exception, is satisfied here, and we're under an abuse of discretion standard for this particular claim. All three requirements of the exception are satisfied. You have a startling event, fact that law enforcement is rushing in, and considering the fact that this is a minor, a victim of human trafficking, and as the testimony showed.
But do you say in response to opposing counsel's argument that recognizing the unfortunate situation that the minor victim was in, this was not her first arrest, so is this really a startling event? And again, might she have some script at the ready in case this were to happen to her?
And I'd just like to clarify one thing. The arrest, there was a stipulation as to the minor victim's prior conviction. It was for a drug offense. This was not for a prostitution offense. My opponent can correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think that makes a difference if the court is going to consider her, and I don't think she should at all be considered some experienced sex worker. She was a minor, and she was manipulated by Mr. Carter. And the court can see, I think, at the top of page 8 of our brief, where we cite a message that she sends to Mr. Carter saying, "You manipulate me. When I turn 18, I'm going to get my own place." So there is some coercion. This is not some rosy relationship. So I do think the fact that she is a minor and a victim still counts in terms of treating this as a startling event, Judge Kidd. And I don't think, moving to the second requirement, there can really be a question that she's under the stress of the startling event when she makes the statements. Again, this is within 30 seconds of law enforcement rushing in. Clear testimony from Detective Villa that she has lost control of her emotions. And then finally, there is a relationship here, in our view, a clear relationship between the startling event, law enforcement coming in, telling her, "We're here for your safety, we're concerned about your welfare," and the statements that she makes saying, "I'm here against my will." So we think there is a nexus there. We do submit that all three requirements are satisfied. We don't think the admission of the statements for, with respect to the rule-based challenge, was an abuse of discretion by the district court. Seems that my time is winding down. Unless this court has any further questions, we would respectfully ask that it affirm the judgment of conviction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Romano. And Mr. Caruso, you have 4 minutes. Thank you.
So I'll try to go backward and go quickly. With regard to the excited utterance exception, you know, there are two things that my friend mentioned that I think sort of bear discussing. One, this text message where Amber said she was going to get her own place. Within that text message, she said she's getting her own bread or own money, which runs counter to the idea that Mr. Carter was prostituting her, because the government's expert testified that, of course, a pimp doesn't allow the people who work for him to keep any of their own money. So this evidence through a text message that Amber had her own money contradicts the government's theory. With regard to whether this was a startling point, to Judge Kidd's question, the government expert also testified that sex workers know how and are ready to evade law enforcement and avoid arrest. So again, I think those facts take it out of the context of being a startling event.
Surely the pimp is not going to coach the prostitute to evade arrest by throwing him under the bus.
So that's true. That's true, but that's also evidence that he was not her pimp. You know, if we have one idea that sex workers are trained not to give up the pimp, but she's giving up the pimp through this statement.
Sounds like it might be because it's an excited utterance.
It could be just because she didn't want to be arrested and was angry and upset, having a temper tantrum, Your Honor. Because I think, as the Sewell case said, and I think Judge Rosenbaum alluded to before, it takes very little time to figure out that the best strategy is to blame someone else. And we think that's what was going on here. With regard to the so-called emergency...
Is opposing counsel correct that she had one, the minor victim had one prior arrest and it was for a drug offense? That's it? She had not been arrested for any sort of commercial sex act?
As far as I know, Honor, that's correct. But I don't take my friend's point that an arrest for a drug possession sort of takes her out of the realm of knowing how to interact with law enforcement. With regard to the so-called emergency exception, you know, we rely primarily on the Supreme Court case Hammond, the Seventh Circuit case Norwood. You know, in our case, Amber was safely in the custody of the police. She had committed a crime in the view of Detective Villa. He was investigating this case. She was not free to leave. She was in no danger. She was in a private hotel room. There was no chance, as the Seventh Circuit said in Norwood, that she was going to be released to the custody of Mr. Carter. So there was no ongoing emergency as it related to Amber. And Hammond is an even stronger case. That's a Supreme Court case where the police went out to a domestic disturbance call. And the woman, the wife who was the declarant, was in the house with her husband, who was the abuser. The police had her in a different room, and the Supreme Court held that she gave testimonial statements not subject to any so-called emergency exception.
Well, and you mentioned that there was no risk that the police were going to hand Amber over to Mr. Carter.
That's
sure,
right.
But the police are in a hotel room, and they don't know where Mr. Carter is. So isn't there an ongoing emergency as to the police officers themselves?
No, we don't believe so, Your Honor.
They know a man was on the phone when they were setting up this date, and they don't know where that man is. So they suspect she has a pimp. They've arranged for this sex date, and now they don't know where the pimp is. Is that not a dangerous situation for the police?
Based on the facts that are in the record, I don't think that's a dangerous situation for the police, Your Honor. They could gain information as to when whoever the person was who was going to come back to the hotel and try to seek to arrest or detain that person. But there's no evidence in the record that the police understood at the time that it was a dangerous situation. And I think the focus has to be more on Amber's statements and whether she was in danger from Mr. Carter. And I think the record is clear that she was not. And again, we'll finish up by saying that we don't believe that the evidence in this case was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and we ask you to vacate Mr. Carter's convictions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.